We are 1 minute and 30 seconds away from broadcast. On my mark, in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, mark. You're listening to the Jim Inkster Show pre-broadcast countdown. We are 1 minute away from broadcast. On my mark, in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, mark. You're listening to the Jim Inkster Show pre-broadcast countdown. We are 30 seconds away from broadcast, at which time we will go silent. On my mark, in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, mark.
This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Jim Caldwell, the marketing director for the Baton Rouge Airport. He has some thoughts about air travel in Baton Rouge. It was a big week for our facility in this city because of the Super Bowl traffic. Also on the show, Dr. Kim Marie Vaz from Xavier University, Associate Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences. Her book is The Baby Dolls: Breaking the Race and Gender Barriers of the New Orleans Mardi Gras Tradition. And we'll talk with the conservative commentator from California, Bruce Hershenson, about the nomination of Senator Chuck Hagel as defense secretary. Many conservatives are not in line with their fellow Republican nominated by President Obama. All this, now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our number, 297-5633, or you may call toll-free wherever you may be at 877-217-5757. Our guest to begin the conversation today is Jim Caldwell, the marketing director for the Baton Rouge Airport, a man who is on the move, literally. And good morning to you, Jim.
Good morning.
Well, it was a big week. A lot of Super Bowl people traveling in and out of Baton Rouge.
It was. We're one of the primary secondary airports, so we got a nice bump in passengers commercially and a big bump in private aircraft coming in, corporate jets.
Well, as far as the rush that happened after Katrina, this was an airport that was overflowing. It settled down a bit, but since then, there have been some major renovations, enhancements. How's the airport post-Katrina?
It's doing well. You know, we did have that blip, which, you know, was a temporary one with post-Katrina when we were the primary alternative airport for New Orleans. And of course, as New Orleans built back up, the levels, you know, dropped back closer to what they had been previously. But we've started growing again. We've had increases in enplanements and deplanements for four consecutive years now. In fact, this 2012 was our best year in 4 years.
When you say best year, what does that mean?
Our total passenger volume was 826,000, which was the best total enplanements and deplanements in 4 years.
That's the number of passengers?
That's right. The enplanements are those originating in Baton Rouge, and deplanements are those coming from other areas. And
so almost a million people traveled in and out of the Baton Rouge airport. And right now, what are the airlines that are available for flying?
We've got all four major network carriers, which is the term the industry uses for the network carriers that have the global alliances that, you know, are so important for business travelers that can literally give them anywhere in the world. And we have those with American, Delta, United, and U.S. Airways.
Well, it's a situation where Baton Rouge is an airport that's vital, being in a capital city. I remember the days when there were flights from Baton Rouge to New Orleans. That's not the case anymore. No. How much competition, if any, is there with the airport in New Orleans?
There is. You know, most airports in the region, you know, do leak some traffic to New Orleans. You know, obviously it's one of the top 10 destination markets in North America. So they have a lot of service that's driven by the meeting, convention business, tourism, things that, you know, don't really drive that much volume into Baton Rouge. And but we still keep a majority of our passengers.
When you say top 10, I think many people may not realize that. New Orleans is such a tourist mecca.
That's right.
It's one of the 10 busiest airports in America.
Well, no, in terms of destination cities for meetings and conventions and tourism, similar to what
right.
Orlando is, not a top 10 airport, although they are in the top 25%.
Well, 297-5633, if you'd like to talk to Jim Caldwell. You may also reach us at inkstershow@wrkf.org. Jim's the marketing director, and you've held this position now for a few years.
Yes, for a little over 4 years.
4 years, and he's got a story to tell. And for years, the airport was it was not something the city was all that proud of, but it looks a lot better, and it's more friendly as far as travel than it once was. What are some of the major things that have happened over your 4 years?
Well, we've bringing U.S. Airways in was important to us, and that's been several years now, because it gave us a primary competitor going east, primarily to Delta, and they've helped bring the fares down and give connecting options over Charlotte we didn't previously have. Obviously, there's a lot of construction going on. Our director Anthony Marino has, you know, been behind trying to upgrade the facility and keep it as one of the most modern facilities in the business. And we have our terminal renovation taking place now, which is going to nearly double the size of our atrium, which will allow us to move security screening to the outer part of the atrium, the newly constructed part, and that's going to free up the existing atrium for an area for passengers, for people waiting on arriving passengers or seeing off passengers. We'll have an arrival court that'll be non-secure. That'll be a spacious area where they can wait. They'll have restrooms, new restrooms, vending. Right now, there's just a very small area at security. And sometimes when you have people seeing a group off or waiting on arriving passengers, it gets congested and creates a little bit of a bottleneck there. So that's going to be a big benefit. And it's going to involve some new restrooms on the concourses, new carpeting throughout, just a lot of upgrades that were needed. You know, all those are over 10 years old now, so the carpeting's wearing thin in many places. And it's going to be just a beautiful facility with the new renovations.
Jeannie asks about parking. She says she likes the fare. It doesn't cost as much, or the fee. It doesn't cost as much to park in Baton Rouge as it does in some other airports, including New Orleans. But she says she wishes there was more of it.
We opened our new car rental parking facility a few years ago, which freed up quite a few spaces because the cars had previously been in the public lot. So we've got both the covered area and the uncovered. So we like it to stay full, of course, which means we're doing well from a passenger count standpoint. But we never have run out of spaces. Sometimes you can't get your first preference at the front when it's a busy time. But appreciate the comment on the parking. It is less expensive than parking at many other airports.
You've worked at other airports.
Well, actually, most of my background is on the airline side, so this is my first airport.
Well, certainly you have been in other airports,
yes.
And you know about parking and those sorts of things. How does Baton Rouge compare in that area?
I think for an airport of its size, it's one of the best in terms of convenience. You know, you rarely have a situation where you can literally park right next to the terminal and just walk across a bridge or walk across a few lanes, and you're there at the check-in position in the ticket counter. So it's certainly one of the most convenient airports. You'll find the facilities are all that you could ask for. We've got easy signage. That's one of the strengths we find in the surveys we do. The people who use us frequently comment most frequently that they like the ease of use, the fact that it's a short drive, that parking's right next to the terminal, that the wait times are typically no more than 5 minutes clearing security. Mm-hmm. So it's a much easier process.
You mentioned security. There have been some changes, as we know, in the last 4 years regarding what it takes to get on a plane. How is that working out?
It's fine. You know, people have adapted to the post 9/11 world, and that was, getting back to the renovation of the terminal, that was one of the reasons for it. You know, pre 9/11, you did not have to be a ticketed passenger to be on the secure side and go through security. So people waiting on arriving passengers or seeing them off would typically go to the gates with them. Post 9/11, that was no longer allowed, which led to kind of the bottleneck we have there. But we've got the newest security screening machines. They are very fast, very efficient. So it's a much better process today than it was right after 9/11.
How does it compare the Baton Rouge Airport as far as fare when you travel from Baton Rouge to another city? Is it competitive with, say, New Orleans?
More so than it has been, in recent years. Obviously, they have more service than we have, but we subscribe to a database and a data miner that the Mike Boyd Group produces, and we can go in and pull all types of data, not only on our airport, but any others. And I was looking at the most recent fare data and comparing it. And in most cases, for example, with Lafayette, we had a slightly lower fare to almost every destination, few exceptions. New Orleans was more of a mix. Certainly they had some lower average fares than we had, but surprisingly, to some people, we actually have some destinations where our average fare is lower than New Orleans.
Leslie asks about direct flights. How many direct flights are there each day from Baton Rouge?
In terms of nonstops, it's hub service flights, so we've got five nonstop destinations: American to Dallas Fort Worth, United to their Houston hub, U.S. Airways to Charlotte, Delta to Atlanta, and Memphis.
We're a regional airport, right?
That's right. And, you know, the airlines tend to focus on the most economical hubs to serve. So we serve all the major hubs that are closest to Baton Rouge.
And when so how is Alexandria an international airport?
Sometimes you can get that through cargo and military flights and other things. So
you only have to have one flight that goes to a foreign destination,
right?
And you're an international airport. So Alexandria and New Orleans are the two in Louisiana. But
and we're actually the second largest airport in Louisiana. In fact, second largest in the region. If you even include other areas such as Gulfport and Mobile.
And the airport in Baton Rouge has been around for some time. We're talking, since the 40s, right?
Yes. Yeah. It was originally a World War II training facility for pilots.
So what do you see as the future, Jim Caldwell, for the airport?
Well, I think, you know, we're in a good position. We our load factors, the percentage of seats filled on the flight, are above 80%. And most industry analysts think if you've got an 80% plus load factor, that you've got spillage. You know, you've got those – always have those slow days, Tuesdays and Wednesdays, when the demand isn't as much. But on the peak days, when you've got that type load factor, it means you probably have more demand than you have seats. So we think we're going to be able to justify additional capacity. In fact, just in the next 60 days, several carriers are adding more flights. American's upgrading to larger regional jets. They'll go from 8 flights round trips a day to Dallas to 10 in March. Delta will be adding a few more flights. Back in November, in fact, they upgraded one of their regional jets to a mainline DC-9. Jet and several other regional jets have been upgraded to larger ones. In fact, Delta acquired the Boeing 717s. They're over 100 seat aircraft, first and coach, and they've mentioned several times to us that they thought that aircraft would be a good fit for Baton Rouge. So,
well, Baton Rouge Airport, now Ryan Field, is been around, as Jim says, since the end of World War II. Originally Harding Army Airfield. And it was used first by the Army Air Force, wasn't it?
That's right. It was a pilot training facility. In fact, I was listening to a book on tape narrated by Tom Hanks not long ago and telling a lot of World War II stories. And it surprised me how often he referred in the stories to Harding Field. Many of the people he talked about got their training there.
Got their training here, and it was an important part of the Second World War. And then, of course, now it's become the airport where most of us do our traveling. If you are seeking to make a reservation quickly and trying to get the best bang for your buck, what's the best way to do that?
Lots of options these days. Many websites, from the better known ones, I guess, like Travelocity and Expedia and Orbitz, Kayak, or the airline websites, themselves. And there's still many good travel agencies that can provide counseling that goes well beyond what you could find on a website.
Well, Jim Caldwell will be with us for a few more minutes. 297-5633, 877-217-5757. Those are your numbers. Jim's the marketing director, has been for the last 4 years for Baton Rouge Metropolitan Airport, 33,000 square feet cargo facility, and it's being expanded to 68,000.
The new cargo facility opened almost 2 years ago, so
you're at almost 70,000 then, right?
Yes, we recently signed a new short-term lease with the Coca-Cola bottling facility to use part of our cargo building.
Well, we'll talk more with Jim Caldwell after this 90-second pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Richard Fisher is producing today, and our guest is Jim Caldwell for a few more minutes. He is the marketing director for the Baton Rouge Airport. 297-5633 is your number. Now, the area around the airport has been enhanced considerably over the last several years. Does that help your cause as far as promoting the airport?
It does, and certainly helps our revenue stream, too, when we can get these long-term leases on our airport properties. Most airports these days are trying to diversify their income and not depend so much on the airlines because there hasn't been as much capacity growth over the recent years. In fact, most analysts are predicting next year that there'll be virtually no capacity growth on the airline side. So with us, we were able to get ABC Auctions broke ground, auto auctions over in our business park on the north side. They'll be open sometime in the spring. That was a good one for us. We've got All-Star Chevrolet just opened a new dealership by the Coca-Cola bottling plant.
Why are so many airlines in financial difficulty?
Well, the high fuel prices, certainly the economy, especially a few years ago, caused difficulties. And that's still an issue, but probably more so is $100 a barrel fuel prices. For example, the 50-seat regional jets that proliferated from the late 90s on today are considered uneconomical for many routes by the major airlines, and they're trying to move up to the larger regional jets that consume slightly more fuel, but you have more passengers per flight, so they're less costly on a per-seat basis.
What's the biggest complaint you usually get, Jim, if any?
We don't have any one single one that stands out. We do get more compliments than complaints, but a lot of people, of course, would like to see more nonstop service, which every airport wants, and we're working hard to get more of. But most of the ones have been related to things we're rectifying, like the arrival court, expanding that area to make room where it's less congested at the check-in area, and with the new restrooms and new carpeting, some of the facility issues are going to be taken care of.
Sometimes people get bumped from flights. That's something that you probably don't have anything to do with, but I'm sure you hear about it.
Oh, we do. The airlines, they have these sophisticated software programs that manage the inventory. They look at what a flight did, same flight a week ago, a month ago, a year ago, and the historical data allows them to pretty accurately overbook a flight, and many times, not actually have an oversell, or if they do, only have a few passengers affected by it that they can, convince to take another flight with compensation. But the difficult thing is when you have something in your city that's not a regular event, and that's mm-hmm. where we come in and try to advise the airlines. For example, with the Bowlers Convention last year, we tried to make them aware that, this is something that your software program won't show because it hasn't been a regular mm-hmm. event, but we're going to need more capacity during these time periods.
Generally, what's the ballpark figure for flights being on time?
Are running as all the air, all the flights combined, we're running in the 83-84% range on time. We're definitely competitive with all the other Gulf region mm-hmm. airports, higher than many. In fact, on the note, the data we get through that product I mentioned earlier, data miner, is usually a few months behind. But for example, when we got November, we actually have some of the primary airports we kind of compare ourselves to. We were either one or two position, depending on the carrier.
And generally, what do you recommend as far as the lead time getting on a flight? When should somebody be at the airport?
We recommend 90 minutes. I'll be the first to admit there are people that get there an hour before and have no problems, but we recommend 90 minutes.
But if you're inside 30 minutes, you might have a problem getting on.
Yeah, I would not risk that because, especially if you're checking a bag.
The bag situation, that's something else that has changed. It now costs to carry those bags or have them checked through. So you got any gripes about that, Jim?
I think people have become more accepting of it. The frequent travelers certainly mm-hmm. know and are prepared for it. And we always recommend mm-hmm. people, if they have any questions about it, go to the TSA website, www.tsa.gov. .gov because they have information about what's restricted, what isn't. And one thing we did about a year ago regarding baggage, we implemented a system of our own where we clock when the flight arrives at the gate, when the pilot sets the parking brake, and then the time to the time the first bag is put on the belt, so we can see the average delivery time. And we've kept those statistics. You know, obviously the airlines have their own staff and they control that, but we try to communicate with them. You know, if we see a particular problem on a certain airline or flights, and since putting that system in place, those numbers have improved dramatically. Most carriers are averaging between 10 and 12 minutes wait time between pulling up to the gate and the bags arriving on the belt.
Well, we wish you well in 2013, and thank you for visiting with us today. Jim Caldwell, Marketing Director for the Baton Rouge Airport.
Thank you.
Take care. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
And we're joined now by Dr. Kim Marie Vaz. She is a professor at Xavier University, the Associate Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, Professor of Education, and her book is The Baby Dolls, Breaking the Race and Gender Barriers of the New Orleans Mardi Gras Tradition. It's from LSU Press. Good morning to you, Dr. Vaz.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Well, nice to talk with you. And the Baby Dolls were started, what, in 1912?
You know, it's thought that they were started in 1912 around the same time as the Zulu Social and Pleasure Club, which in the beginning called themselves the Tramps. And the organizers of both groups knew each other. They worked and lived and played and had a great time around the Perdido Gravier Street area. So, yes, it's a tradition that goes back 100 years now.
Well, the Baby Dolls were a fascinating group, one of the first women's organizations to mask in a Mardi Gras parade. They were called the Million Dollar Baby Dolls.
Right. The reason that they're so significant is in 1912, it was unseemly for women to go on the street during Mardi Gras in costume. People who were considered respectable, especially women, wore long skirts, wouldn't bare their legs, and would never be, out on the streets. They'd be on balconies or in communities, safely watching parades from a distance. But times were changing during that time, and women were wanting more freedoms. And the Million Dollar Baby Dolls were already women who had broken a lot of boundaries and barriers, and they wore little short skirts in their line of business. And one day they came out. They had heard that another group of women who worked in Storyville were making up to mask, they said. And we don't know how they're making up, but we know that we want a mask. And so they took the costumes, sort of the at-hand nature of the things that they had, little short skirts and their ability to dance, and they said, we're going to be baby dolls, and we're going to be red hot. And the idea of being red hot was associated with the jazz music of the times. And jazz was music for young people. It was new. It was meant for dancing. And these women loved to dance. And because they didn't have a lot of opportunities that women have today, women couldn't vote. Women certainly couldn't get really good educations. The only thing that they had that they could make a statement using was their clothing, their ability to sing and dance and to dress. And one Mardi Gras day, they said, we're going to come out as baby dolls, and we're going to be sharp and, you know, looking 40, fine and mellow, as they said. And they came out flinging money at men. They had money in their little garters, and they were smoking cigars, and they were kind of appropriating male behavior that was, that they could kind of satirize, and it made quite a scene.
The guest is Dr. Kim Marie Vaz, Associate Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Xavier, and the author of The Baby Dolls, Breaking the Race and Gender Barriers of the New Orleans Mardi Gras Tradition. And these ladies, let's be frank, they came from the red light district, didn't they?
They did indeed. New Orleans had a red light district from 1897 to 1917, and it was called Storyville. But the ordinance that created Storyville created two sections. It created one section that we commonly know, which sits right outside of the famous Treme community. And it created another area, which we call Black Storyville. Storyville proper was only for the pleasure of white men. Black men could not, it was not appreciated for black men to really go into Storyville. They could go into work, but they really had to get out. So the Perdido and Gravier Street area was an area of businesses for African Americans, but it was also an area for vice, you know, and so they just incorporated sort of the ordinance, took that area and said, you know, this is going to be for vice, but then they held it in abeyance, so it was never really a legal red light area, even though prostitution and gambling were legal in Storyville. But so this was an area in which these particular women worked. And there's one woman whose name rises from history and tells an interesting story about what life was like for the women who worked in the Gravier Perdido Street area, which is around where our current City Hall is in New Orleans.
Yeah, and, it's where Louis Armstrong was born, isn't it?
Well, it's where he grew up. He grew up on the streets, you know, in that area. And the area has been described as very poor. The buildings were dilapidated largely. They were in disrepair. Louis Armstrong himself talked about how buildings were always falling down, and so you could find bricks, and people had a lot of brick fighting that they did. And that it was just a very, very poor area. So people lived a hand-to-mouth existence. And that's what makes the baby doll so significant as well, because even in the very difficult circumstances of their lives, they appropriated Mardi Gras to have fun, to allow their spirits to soar. There was no route that like we have all of these routes that we can look online and see where the parades are going. That wasn't the case then. People in African American tradition, masking traditions, went where their spirit led them, and the baby dolls were like that. They went from street to street singing vaudeville songs, very risque lyrics that they made up on their own, and they danced. And every street was like a new audience, and they would perform again, you know, for each new audience.
Did these women feel like they were victims?
There is nothing in the narratives that, the few existing narratives that I have read, and in the stories of descriptions, primarily from male jazz musicians, that say anything about these women feeling like victims. In fact, it was complete opposite. They were very tough. They were very strong women. There's a wonderful way of looking at this. One jazz musician said, you know, I really admired these women, not because of the business that they were in, but because of the business they made of their business. Mm-hmm. And I think that we can look at it in those terms, that they took something they took their life circumstances that they found themselves in and really created an expressive art form that middle class and respectable women began to imitate.
It is curious that a century ago, New Orleans was a segregated city, and yet, as you note, Dr. Vaz, white businessmen quite often would go into the red light district and enjoy the company of the baby dolls.
Yes. In fact, sex across the color line was something that the business owners in Storyville very much promoted. That was one of the key attractions. So men were able to transgress those boundaries as much as they wanted to and then go back into their communities and be considered respectable. And those who were involved made a lot of money. And that was the reality of the time.
Well, were the people involved, were they black people or were they white people making money?
Well, in the Storyville district, there were some black women who were very successful. There were some madams, Lulu White and Countess Willie Piazza. They owned a lot of property in Storyville. They made a lot of money. One of the famous, if not infamous, houses of prostitution was owned by Lulu White, her Mahogany Hall. They decorated them in lavish, probably very gaudy styles. But one woman, Willie Countess Willie, she had a good library. So they also aspired to middle class, you know, they had middle class aspirations for culture. They hired jazz musicians. They were real businesswomen because they had to oversee servants, the women themselves who were working in the houses, the maintenance and repair of the facilities, the advertising of their business. So they did make quite a handsome sum of money, but most women didn't. Most women, black women especially, lived a more hand to mouth existence.
297-5633 is our number. In our remaining time with Dr. Kim Marie Vaz at Xavier University, she follows the baby doll phenomenon through the 100 years with photos, articles, interviews, and concludes with the birth of contemporary groups emphasizing these organizations' contributions to our cultural history. Now, there are some remnants, to say the least, of the baby dolls today.
Absolutely. There is a revival or a resurrection of the baby dolls. It started about 2002 with the late Antoinette Cato, who was married to the well-known R&B singer Ernie Cato, who's famous for his mother-in-law song. And after Ernie died, Antoinette wanted to keep his name before the public. She even went so far as to have a life-size mannequin of him made that she carried around. She was a Mardi Gras icon. She loved Mardi Gras. And she decided that since there weren't a lot of baby dolls to be seen, like the number of Mardi Gras Indians that could be seen, she decided she would form a group of baby dolls because she had seen them in her youth. She was very insistent that the baby dolls of today don't follow the same practices that the baby dolls of yesterday followed.
You have a chapter, Women Dancing the Jazz. These women were exceptional dancers, and you note that there were two types of dances that were particularly popular in these dance halls, saloons, and brothels.
Well, dance is part of what a parade is for African Americans. It's often said that, you know, white people didn't necessarily need music to accompany their parades because there was no dancing, but you absolutely had to have bands if you were going to be in an African American parade because it was all about the dancing. And the musicians have always followed the movements of the people rather than the reverse. So it was a symbiotic relationship between music and dance. And these women danced for money, but they also danced because there was a long second-line tradition of dancing, and that grew out of jazz, what we have come to call jazz funerals, in which the brass band would play very somber tunes going to lay the body to rest, but when the body was cut loose and they'd come back, they'd dance and they'd be rejoicing.
We'll be back with Dr. Kim Marie Vaz of Xavier University. Her book from LSU Press, The Baby Dolls, back after this 90-second pause. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number in our remaining time with Dr. Kim Marie Vaz of Xavier University. Her book is The Baby Dolls, Breaking the Race and Gender Barriers of the New Orleans Mardi Gras Tradition, a compelling book from LSU Press about a group of ladies who started just over a century ago in New Orleans. And as we prepare for Mardi Gras, much of the tradition is owed to the baby dolls with their short satin dresses, stockings with garters. They were quite a spectacle in their day, and of course, as we know, Dr. Vaz, New Orleans remains a place of excess and certainly a curiosity when it comes to this time of the year.
Oh, absolutely. And you'll be able to see baby dolls all throughout the city now. There's been such a resurgence, starting with Antoinette Cato and the Ernie K. baby dolls, the Gold Digger baby dolls, which are in the Treme. There was a family, the Batiste family, Uncle Lionel, who just passed, and the city celebrated his life. Many baby dolls came out because his mother had been a baby doll. She had her own group. His sisters had masked as baby dolls. And people, the modern baby dolls, they all learned from Miss Marion Batiste, who's still alive and still masks as a baby doll when she can get to New Orleans. This time of a year, they're all getting their costumes together, their little short skirts and umbrellas, and they're getting ready to get out on the streets and continue the dance tradition.
Well, we thank you for spending time with us today, Dr. Kim Marie Vaz from Xavier, and congrats on an outstanding book, The Baby Dolls.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
We're joined now by Bruce Hershenson, the commentator from California, from the conservative side of the political spectrum. Good morning to you, Bruce.
Hi, Jim. How are you doing?
Doing well, and of course, a professor at Pepperdine University. He's been around the block many times. He was a fellow at the Harvard John F. Kennedy School of Government and has taught politics at the University of Maryland and also Whittier College, the alma mater of his former boss, Richard Nixon. Bruce Hershenson, today's the 102nd birthday, by the way, of Ronald Wilson Reagan. You knew him as well, didn't you?
I sure did. Marvelous, marvelous guy. And I believe a great president.
Well, would he have nominated Chuck Hagel as his defense secretary?
Not a chance.
Why not?
Because of his history in terms of those things that he has articulated his own positions on during his, 12 years in the Senate. I mean, just, I'm certain, there's no question, you don't need me to hear this, they're not positions that President Reagan believed in.
Well, he is a Republican, and he is a warrior. He fought with valor in his day, a Vietnam vet. Those are things I would think you would be impressed with.
Not enough. I'm always impressed if someone fights with valor, and he did, naturally. The fact that he's a Republican is almost insignificant to me. The political party does not mean necessarily what you believe in. And those things that he said so often about so many subjects, particularly in foreign policy, are those positions that, in my own view, and I believe in the view of every Republican president in my lifetime, would have been rejected. So that certainly takes precedence. When I hear someone's a Republican, that doesn't make me automatically say, oh, well, then he's right, I'd vote for him. I will say this, that generally, I do believe that the Senate should back whatever a president wants, whomever a president wants, just because he wants people around him who he agrees with. Well, I think that's really the statement here, and probably the most important statement. It's a statement to the world. The president wants someone who believes those things. He probably has the same beliefs as the president. Or why would the president nominate him? And so that, to me, is terribly significant. It is a confirmation of those things that many in the world believed but didn't really have a confirmation before, that this is what the president wants. This is the kind of person, in terms of policymaking, that the president wants.
297-5633 if you'd like to talk to Bruce Hershenson, a conservative commentator who spent many years in the media business. He's also, of course, as we note, a man who is prominent on campuses, including Pepperdine University, and he almost won the 1992 U.S. Senate election, losing a tight one to Barbara Boxer, who's still there after all these years. Now, as far as Chuck Hagel, what is it about him that you don't like?
Well, I don't want to go into a whole litany, but will until you stop me. He said the United States should negotiate with Hamas. He said that let me just mention this because it's rather significant. Iran's foreign minister said that his nomination makes him hopeful that the United States is changing its policies. Hagel was one of, I believe it was four senators who refused to sign a letter that affirmed U.S. solidarity with Israel in the face of, at that time, the intifada, the Palestinian aggression. He was one of two senators, and then I'm sure, who voted against a bill extending sanctions against Iran. He urged President Bush, G.W. Bush, to support Iran's membership in the World Trade Organization. Hagel said that the Pentagon's budget is bloated, whereas Panetta said that sequestration would be devastating to our defense and would have a, I believe the word he used was catastrophic effect. Hagel called the battle in Iraq as an occupation. He opposed the surge in Iraq, which was successful, calling it the most dangerous foreign policy blunder in this country since Vietnam. I memorized that one. There was one other.
All right.
I can go on. I won't.
Well, he took a blistering, mainly from Republicans, almost exclusively from Republicans, when he testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee. You're a gentleman. Do you think they roughed him up inappropriately?
No. I would have asked the same kinds of questions, because those are questions that you want answered. I just gave the charges. It's not fair of me, but Hagel isn't on the line to just give these charges. But they gave the charges. I think they gave pretty much this what I just said and a lot more. And terrific. That's the purpose of a confirmation hearing. You have the guy in front of you. And so he was in front of them, and he could answer them. And by God, he was terrible. I mean, he was really terrible on his answers. Some of the things he just didn't even know, or he wouldn't answer. And so, no, I don't think they roughed him up. I think they did precisely what they're supposed to do at a confirmation hearing.
What do you think about John Kerry being Secretary of State? Are you?
Well, I was against him, but I don't feel the same way that I do about Hagel. Of course, I was against him after what he said to another hearing, at another hearing after Vietnam. But in the case of Secretary of State, look, the Secretary of State's job is to negotiate. That's their job, diplomacy and negotiation. So no matter who you get, it's going to be a negotiator. I believe in negotiations with nations that are friendly or even sort of on the brink. I do not believe that you can ever negotiate with the tyranny. And they have every negotiation in my lifetime that America has made, that the U.S. has made with a tyranny, has fallen through the cracks.
Well, the president, we visited with you before the election. He won by almost 5 million votes in mm-hmm. popular vote, and I think about 3 million of that was in your state of California. But mm-hmm. He is popular enough that he's gotten two elections with over 51% of the votes. Two other presidents in your lifetime have done that, FDR and Dwight Eisenhower. How do you explain Obama?
Oh, no, more than that. I mean, Nixon got 49 states, 50,
yeah, but, 62% but he,
of the vote.
No,
but
he did not get 51% of the votes in 1968, and Reagan didn't get 51% of the votes.
No, but I'm talking about 72, a second term.
No, I'm talking about two straight times.
Oh, I see. I'm sorry.
Obama, Eisenhower,
I'm sorry. I apologize. I didn't know that's what you meant.
Yeah. Well, anyway, he's popular. How do you explain it?
I don't. The people like him. I don't explain it. I don't think that every president in my lifetime were presidents I wanted to be. to have as presidents, but that's the way it goes. We live in a democracy. You get the government you deserve. Sometimes you're delighted that people agree with you. Sometimes you're not at all delighted, and you hope for someone else to come next time. That's what a democracy is. I don't explain it, but I do say that I believe the people who voted for the president are as responsible for his administration as the person himself, particularly on a second term.
Well, he is, as we know, a Democrat. There is a Democratic U.S. Senator, Mary Landrieu, who is on the fence on the Hagel nomination, the senator from Louisiana. Do you think Hagel will be, when all is said and done, will he be approved?
I never make prophecy, ever, because you can too often be surprised by it. The indications are now that he probably will make it. And I'm talking indications, but I could be way wrong. But the indications are that he will make it, but he won't make it by much because there are some Democrats who are opposed to him, too.
He also made some anti-gay remarks when President Clinton appointed Ambassador Ormel. In fact, the ambassador was a guest on this show. Those remarks have not been played up too much, but nonetheless, they're out there, and the log cabin Republicans are after Senator.
Well, I know they are, but I don't comment much on that because I'm talking about defense, about foreign policy, about what he said about Israel, about what he said about Iran, about what he did in a letter to Yeltsin, or wouldn't sign a letter to Yeltsin regarding anti-Semitism in Russia. All of the things that I talk about, not only with Hagel, but just about anyone, is because it's sort of my specialty, or most of my life has been devoted to it, foreign policy and defense.
We have a question. Do you think Secretary Clinton did a good job?
I think that she did a competent job, but as I said about secretaries of state, there isn't really any of them that I thought were terrific as secretaries of state. None of them. None of them at all.
Including Kissinger?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I do. I feel that way about all secretaries because they have a job to do. It is always diplomacy and negotiation. And so often they spend so much of their time. God, did she spend a lot of time trying to woo North Korea. It ain't going to be wooed. Tyrannies are not wooed. They have no problem with signing a document for a foreign nation at the same time, of course, killing their own citizens. That's what tyrannies are all about. They don't care what they say to someone else. They don't care about their signatures. So, yes, I feel that way about practically every... Look, I'll take Condoleezza Rice, she, who I just think the world of as a person. She was a great national security advisor. I hoped she would not accept Secretary of State because now she's going to be a mile away from the president. She's going to have as a job diplomacy, not advice. And I think that she was a much better national security advisor than she was Secretary of State, but that's because that's the job of the Secretary of State, and I don't like it.
CB asks a question of you, Bruce, from your perch in California, where you were a prominent commentator. What do you know about Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana, who's apparently making a quest for the presidency?
I like him from what I know of him, but I certainly am not as familiar with him as you are and as the people of Louisiana are. You know, I'm not so sure they know a great deal about Governor Brown here of California. And I have to say, and just admit to you very candidly, that my stress and my every day and every night for decades has been devoted to foreign policy.
I know. It has. And, of course... Governor Jindal, if he runs for president, he'll be talking about foreign policy.
Oh, of course.
And Governor Brown has run for president 3 times. Is he going to run again?
I don't doubt it at all. I just don't doubt it. He's an amazing guy. I will say that.
You say that with almost relish. There's something about...
No, not relish. Admiration. Well, and also, there are a number of things that we had agreed on. Once I was supposed to do a debate with him, and it wasn't a debate at all. We were just laughing and talking about the one thing we both agreed on, and that was a flat rate tax. He's very high on a flat rate tax. So am I. And he's a very congenial guy. Whether or not you agree or disagree with him, and generally I disagree with him very, I mean, in terms of policy, but he's a very, very nice guy. He reminds me of the older politics, when I was more involved, in which Republicans and Democrats got along with each other quite well.
You, for many years, were a commentator on KABC television.
Good memory.
Television and radio. That's kind of a lost art, political commentary, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a great start. It was just wonderful. One thing it does do, as you obviously well know, it sure builds up your name recognition, and for good or ill, name recognition means a heck of a lot when you run for office. And it was marvelous. It was Monday through Friday for 14 years. So, sure, it was a it was an advantage just to have been on for all of that period, all of that time.
We had Eric Severide for many years on CBS News.
That's right.
And you were doing the same kind of thing in California. And I remember when I was a kid in New Orleans, we had nightly commentaries as well.
Yes. Now they're not as frequent as they used to be, or they're pretty well reserved, I think, for cable. But certainly in local news, you rarely see commentary.
And a commentator, an author, a professor, and a public servant as well. And it all started for you, Bruce Hershenson, at RKO Pictures?
It sure did. I was a messenger boy. And right after high school, I got a job. Well, first I got a job at Ralph's Grocery, and then a job at RKO as a messenger boy. Started making films, and later on, when I say started, I could win in the service then. Then started making films.
Well, we got a roll. We got
a bigger part.
We've got a roll, but thank you, and it's always a pleasure, my friend.
It is for me. Thanks.
Take care, Bruce Hershenson. And that's it for today. Until tomorrow, for Richard Fisher, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.